Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show. This show is brought to you by ChrisCresser.com, and I'm your host, Steve Wright. My website is SDLifestyle.com, but the star of this show is Chris Cresser. He's an integrative medical practitioner, licensed acupuncturist, and a healthy skeptic. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm feeling pretty good, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well as well.
Yeah? I've got some interesting news, or at least good news for me. I think we've talked before about using a standing desk. I started out about, 8-9 months ago, because I spent a fair amount of time on the computer writing and doing everything else that I do. So, and especially with the book coming up, I just didn't like the idea of sitting on my butt that much. So I got a standing desk for my office, and I still have a sitting desk, so I alternate between the two, but I spend a fair amount of time at the standing desk. But even that still didn't quite feel like enough to me. And I've been aware of treadmill desks for a while, and I've just been kind of thinking about it in the back of my mind. I've kind of had an unfair bias against treadmills and Stairmasters and indoor exercise machines like that, because I'd much prefer to get exercise outdoors. But if the trade-off is, I have to do the work I do. So if I'm going to be doing that work and I'm going to be inside doing it, then I might as well be moving while I'm doing it. That was my thinking. So I did some research and I found, there's a whole bunch of different options out there. There's some like treadmills and desks that are sold together, but I already had a standing desk. So I just looked for the tread itself and found one that would fit under my desk. And so I got it earlier this week. And on Wednesday, I set it up. Yesterday was my first day, and I logged about 7 miles in the midst of writing a little bit on my book and doing a shift with patients, doing some phone consulting yesterday. So I don't think anybody heard it. It's very quiet. I called up Dan Party before and said, "Can you hear this thing?" And he couldn't. So and nobody mentioned it. So and it went pretty well. I felt great. It was really exciting to be at the end of a work day and feel like I was out walking for 6 miles, which is just fantastic. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Did you notice your energy levels stay higher, or did you notice anything in regards to thinking?
Definitely my energy was higher. I think better when I'm moving too. So to a certain extent, I think there are certain times when if I really have to focus on something and concentrate really hard, I might still want to use the sitting desk for that. I don't know. It's still kind of in the experimentation process. And I was messing around with the speed too. Like 1 mile an hour seems to be about the right speed for being able to type and work efficiently. If I increase the speed much beyond that, it starts to be a little hard to do. And I was actually starting to feel almost like a little bit car sick. If I read in the car, I don't feel well. The kind of bouncing up and down and reading doesn't work for me. So the faster speed on the treadmill was similar to that, and it was just harder to manage the typing. But 1 mile an hour, so it was pretty good. And at that pace, I think I used it. I can't remember exactly how many hours, but probably 3 to 4 hours total. I guess it was more like six, if it was 6 miles. And I was doing 1 mile an hour. I had some periods where I was going faster when I wasn't typing and I was just talking on the phone. But I'll keep reporting back.
Yeah, we're going to press you for an update, you for an update. I was speaking from the listener's point of view.
Yeah, and if people are interested, we can, they can leave some comments and I'll post like a little bit about the research I did and which ones are available and which are quiet and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't mean to totally derail the podcast, but do you have one of the pneumatic desk that lifts up, so you're able to adjust it pretty easily?
No, I don't. I just have a fixed standing desk because, as I said, I have another sitting desk, so I didn't really feel it was necessary to have an adjustable standing desk because I'm not going back and forth from sitting to standing at the same desk. And I did have to get a keyboard tray that would extend out from underneath the desk because a lot of the standing desks only have one surface, and that's not correct ergonomically. To have the monitor should be at eye level, but the keyboard should be at elbow level. So there needs to be like a keyboard tray underneath the top of the desk, or, and if it doesn't come with one, you can buy one and attach it to the underneath of the desk, underside of the desk. So maybe I'll write an article where we can actually do a longer episode about this if there's interest. We'll see.
Yeah, and we'll get you to divulge your brands in the ones you chose.
I'll take a picture of my setup. Uh-oh. Post it on.
Going inside the Cresser crib.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're doing a Q&A episode, right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and give you a quick break to review the questions we're going to cover. I'm going to tell everyone about Beyond Paleo. Now, if you're new to this podcast, you're new to the paleo diet, or you're just interested in optimizing your health, being as it's December, a lot of people are going to be into that, you're going to want to check out Beyond Paleo. Beyond Paleo is a free 13-part email series that Chris has put together that includes all of his best tips and tricks on burning fat, boosting energy, and preventing and reversing disease without drugs. So if you want this, which you should at this point because it's pretty awesome and I'm making a pretty compelling offer right now, go over to chriscresser.com, look for the big red box, go ahead and put your name and email in there, and Chris is going to start sending you free emails. So great information, highly recommend you check it out. Chris, are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. And I'm not walking right now, in case anyone's wondering. I was trying to figure out a way out to do it with the podcast if it wasn't going to mess up the audio quality. But I need some kind of arm to attach to the desk that will and the microphone to kind of swivel it out to where the treadmill is. So I'm working on it, but... So I have to just be plain old standing up for this one.
Well, if you do that, then we're going to have to do a video podcast because I want to see this.
Yeah. And maybe I'm the only podcast. I'm probably not. There's so many people doing this stuff. I bet there is someone who's doing it on the treadmill. But who knows? We'll see. So before we do a Q&A, I want to talk just very briefly about an interesting study that was published in The Lancet today. I just heard about it like 20 minutes before we started recording this, so I didn't have a chance to go over it in detail. But it was a collaboration of 486 scientists from 302 institutions in 50 countries around the world, so pretty comprehensive. It's called the Global Burden of Disease Study from 2010. And the idea is just to get a sense of what the global burden of disease is and how it's changed over the years. And the conclusion, very roughly, was that the life expectancy for both men and women is increasing pretty much everywhere around the world. But the burden of chronic disease and disability is increasing. So mental health disorders, substance use, musculoskeletal disease, diabetes, chronic respiratory disease, autoimmune disease, etc., are all increasing. So we're living longer, but we're getting more sick as we live longer. So this is, of course, a discussion that comes up a lot when we talk about ancestral health and lifespan and ancestral communities. And it's true that our lifespan today is longer than it's ever been, but I think there's been a significant trade-off. You know, we have a lot of pretty miraculous modern medical interventions that have been able to extend our life, both at the, you know, early on during childhood and infancy, and then later during the end of life. But it's pretty clear that our modern lifestyle has made our lives worse in between, you know, so we're living longer, but arguably the quality of life and the quality of our health while we're alive is worse than it than it was certainly for thousands of years until the introduction of the modern industrial lifestyle. So I just thought it was interesting. I'm going to review it and maybe we'll talk about it a little bit later. But since it was fresh, I wanted to at least mention it.
Yeah, I think I saw those same headlines and it's going to be interesting. They were saying something, I think the quote that I read on CNN about it that they pulled out of the study, which of course this is, you know, journalism now and marketing, but they basically said that the healthcare or the obesity overweight problem is now worse than the hunger problem.
Yeah. Here's a couple stats. 1 in 4 deaths was from heart disease or stroke. That's just amazing. You know, it's like the fact that the Interheart study a while back suggested that 90% of heart disease is preventable by modifying diet and lifestyle. And yet still today, after all of the focus on heart disease over decades, it's still the major cause of death. Diabetes deaths are increasing, and of course obesity is a big part of that. And actually, the biggest global risk factor for disease, you want to take a guess what it is?
Obesity.
Blood pressure, hypertension. That's the number one risk factor for global disease. I was surprised too when I read that. Yeah. So yeah, we'll come back to this, but I just want to throw it out there. I think it highlights some of the issues that the modern lifestyle presents and some of the trade-offs that we've had to face because of through our adoption of the modern lifestyle. We've definitely got a lot of benefit from it, of course, through modern medical care, but there have been, it hasn't come without a cost.
So true. Okay. Well, we will move on. So we do get through some questions on this podcast, but I think we should definitely spend some time on that study a little bit later.
All right, okay. Let's do it.
This first question comes from Jennifer, and she says, "Hi, Chris. I have a question regarding regulating hormones after getting off birth control pills. For the last 2 years, I've immersed myself in healthy living, following a paleo diet, supplementing, and using natural skincare, and I've never felt better. The last step for me was to get off the pill, which I have been on for 7 years. I've been off the pill now for almost 2 months, and my skin is going insane. I'm breaking out horribly, and I've tried numerous efforts to get it under control, including maca powder, detoxifying the liver with milk thistle phytosome, and detox tincture from the herbalist. Is this something I'll have to just wait out for my body to get back to normal? What else can I do?"
Yeah, so this is common. There's actually a condition known as post-birth control syndrome, and it's a label for the hormonal imbalance that is that frequently occurs after a woman gets off birth control pills, especially if she's been on them for quite a long time. So one answer is yes, it will, you know, it may resolve over time on its own, but there are other things that can be done that could probably help that process along. Proper hormone balance, there are some basic contributing factors that should be addressed. As a beginning step, it sounds like a lot of them probably already have been addressed in this case, but that would be proper blood sugar regulation. Blood sugar has a profound influence on hormones. When female sex hormones go out of balance, there's almost always an adrenal hormone imbalance underneath that, because pregnenolone and DHEA, two of the main adrenal hormones, are precursors to all of the sex hormones. So if there are adrenal issues, if there's like the pregnenolone steal is going on where pregnenolone is being diverted into cortisol production at the expense of DHEA and estrogen and progesterone, that can cause issues. Liver and gallbladder detoxification is crucial, as she seems to be aware, because one of the liver's jobs is to clear out excess hormones that are built up in the system, which is something that would happen over time after using birth control. So she may need more intensive liver support than she's getting right now. Fatty acid balance is really also crucial for hormone regulation, making sure that she's getting enough long chain omega-3 fats and not too much linoleic acid, the omega-6 fat. Gut health of course, another major player in hormone regulation. So these are all basic foundational things that can be addressed to try to improve hormone health. Beyond that, this is one situation where bioidentical hormones, particularly progesterone in a cyclical augmentation protocol can be really useful. And what I mean by that is progesterone, women don't produce it in the same amount throughout the entire month. It's produced in a cycle, right? Just like estrogen. The levels will be fairly low during the first half of the cycle, peak in the mid cycle, and then stay elevated throughout the second half of the cycle, dropping down fairly precipitously just before menstruation. That's the typical monthly cycle for hormone production. And what often happens in post-birth control syndrome is there can be a problem with the distribution of progesterone throughout the second half of the cycle. So maybe progesterone is dropping too quickly. That's the most common problem, or it's not peaking in the right spot. There can be a problem with the overall production of progesterone or estrogen throughout the whole cycle. And there can be a problem with the timing of ovulation. It's maybe happening too soon or too late or not at all, or even in some more rare cases, twice, which I've seen a few times on hormone panels. So working with a practitioner who understands hormone regulation is probably a good idea. It can really expedite the process of recovering from post-birth control syndrome. Getting a good monthly hormone test is really important. As I just said, hormones are produced in different amounts at different points in the cycle. So getting a single hormone test on one day of the month, it tells you something. You know, it tells you what the hormones were doing on that day. And if you do it on a certain day of the month, like midway through the luteal phase, you can kind of extrapolate some information from that. But really, for a woman who's still cycling, the best test to get is a complete monthly hormone profile where you take samples all the way through the month of progesterone and estrogen, and then you chart the cycle out so you can see where the problem is. And you look at the cycle that is on the graph and you on the chart, and you compare that to what we know the cycle should actually look like. And then you use a protocol that is customized for that particular presentation. So you give more progesterone when progesterone is needed and less or none at all when it's not needed. So those are all steps to take. If the basic stuff has already been tried and it's not working, then I think the next step would be to find a practitioner that does this kind of testing and treatment. Reed Davis's group is Functional Diagnostic Nutrition, I think it is, FDN. That might be a good resource. We'll put a URL to his website where you can find people who are trained in this kind of testing and treatment. The Institute of Functional Medicine and maybe the Paleo Physicians Network, those are all potential places to look.
Yeah, and I would echo that with anybody that's been through Kalish's functional training will have covered this in depth.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for mentioning that. Do you know, I don't know if there is a directory of those folks. Is there on his website?
There is not. And that's on my prodding list of things to get him to do. So,
right. Yeah. It seems like that would be useful.
Yeah. He's been training them for over 7 years now. So there's at least a couple hundred of them out there somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and one thing I want to throw out there, Chris, and you know, maybe it's not that big of a deal, but she's talking about taking milk thistle here. And as far as I understand, that's more of a phase one style detox enhancer, and that she might want to focus, if she's going to continue to use that in the meantime before she finds another practitioner, to also incorporate a phase two, something like NAC.
Yeah, that's
or
good
something.
Point. I like Amino Detox from Designs for Health for phase two support. And just to clarify everybody, there's two or three phases of liver detox. It depends on what kind of classification you're using. But in phase one, what often happens is that we've talked about this before on a previous episode, which we linked to it for a much more complete discussion. But what often happens is in people is their phase two detox is impaired, and then they end up taking quote, liver detox products that upregulate phase one, and then there's a bottleneck because the phase two isn't happening right. So you get this this production of free radicals that happens in phase one, and then the body cannot clear those out in phase two. And so it actually can sometimes make the situation worse than it was to begin with. So it's really important to pay attention to both of those phases of liver detox when you're doing a protocol like this.
Awesome. Okay, well, let's move on to the next question. This question comes from Tasha, and she says, "Hi, Chris. I recently discovered your podcast and blog, and I love it. My question is in regards to canker sores. If they're not caused by injuries such as biting your cheek, why are they popping up? Do you have any suggestions on how to decrease or eliminate the frequency of canker sores and to shorten the healing time? Mine usually take about 2 weeks to heal, and I've been using SLS-free toothpaste for years with no improvement. I haven't been able to correlate them with any food allergy or intolerance. A friend told me that she heard that it could be autoimmune related. Another suggestion was B12 deficiency. I'm rather new to the paleo and Weston Price diets, so I'm just starting to incorporate more saturated animal fats, pasture-raised meats, and sprouted grains from seeds."
Yeah, so canker sores, there's a lot of different theories on what causes them. They're not very well understood, actually. And we want to distinguish here between canker sores and cold sores. Cold sores are caused by herpes simplex 1 virus, and canker sores may actually be viral. Some people think they are viral or bacterial, but the more conventional view is that they're caused by stress, an impaired immune system, nutritional deficiencies like B12, as she mentioned, or zinc or folate or iron deficiency, although there's not a lot of evidence to support that. There's also a correlation between canker sores and gut disorders like inflammatory bowel disease, so Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, and celiac disease. So there's a correlation between gluten intolerance and canker sores. So Tasha mentioned that she's doing the Weston A. Price approach, and she mentioned sprouted grains. I would definitely try removing gluten entirely from the diet if you haven't done that already, because there can be a connection there. As far as helping with the healing process, once you already have the canker sore, there are a few ideas. One, you can do a golden seal mouth rinse. Golden seal is an antimicrobial botanical from the, it's used in both Western and Chinese medicine. So you could dissolve some golden seal, like the one capsule of golden seal powder in 1 cup of warm water, and then add a quarter teaspoon of sea salt to that and swish that around in the mouth. So that's one thing. Manuka honey has pretty powerful wound healing properties. So if you get like a 200 plus or a 400 plus potency Manuka honey and apply that directly to the canker sore, that can help a lot. DGL, deglycerinated licorice, that also has mucosal healing properties. So you can make a paste with the powder and just with your saliva. So you like put some of the saliva in the powder, make a paste with it, and then apply that paste to the canker sore. And you can actually add some slippery elm powder to that too. That's another botanical with mucosal healing properties. And then you could try an internal antimicrobial like monolaurin extract. Lauricidin is the brand that I use in my practice. That has antiviral properties and has some activity against gram-negative bacteria and some gram-positive bacteria as well. So I think all of those together would probably have a pretty good effect on healing. And lauricidin, to some extent, could be used for prevention, but I think just optimizing the nutrient density of the diet, as you're starting to do with paleo, with Weston A. Price type of approach, avoiding gluten, and then taking other steps to boost your immune system, which we talked about on the last podcast, and then on a previous podcast, we've talked about that in the context of dealing with viral infections. So listen to those or read the transcripts for some additional tips on immune regulation.
Yeah, it seems like all the diseases that you mentioned that were correlated with canker sores are kind of diseases that revolve around an underlying condition of a high inflammation. So she might also look into, you know, really analyzing her stress and her sleep too.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, stress is very strongly correlated. And a lot of people who have canker sores report that they tend to get breakouts when they're under a lot of stress. So that's important.
Awesome. Let's keep on rolling. Okay, this question comes from Ben, and he says, in light of the recent Dan's Plan post on vitamin D toxicity, any tips for night shift workers in getting vitamin D? I work from 6:30 p.m. to 7 a.m. 3 or 4 days a week. We rotate days and nights every 3 months. Should I just supplement or adjust my sleep schedule on days I'm off in order to get some sunlight? Any other suggestions for us shift workers?
Well, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but my thing is with vitamin D and with many conditions and nutrients is to test, not guess. It's relatively simple to determine what level of, you know, how much vitamin D to take. It takes time, but it's simple. You test your levels, and I think still the bulk of the evidence suggests that being somewhere between 35 and 55 or 60 is a safe and beneficial level for most people. There are some caveats to that, and there are some recent studies that have come out that suggest lower levels might be better for certain people. Chris Masterjohn and Stefan Guinea and I have been, and Matt Lalonde and I have been corresponding about this quite a bit lately. It appears that there are some genetic mutations that affect vitamin D metabolism and regulation, and so that may explain these differences in studies where some populations seem to do better with lower levels of vitamin D, whereas other populations seem to do better with higher. So I think it's a lot more complicated than we've been led to believe by like the Vitamin D Council, who, you know, is telling everyone to get their levels up to 70 or 80. I've long been not a fan of that, as I've said many times, but the way to figure out your optimal dose of vitamin D is to first get tested. And let's say you come back and your levels are low, let's say they're 25, then you might start taking 4,000 IU per day, 4,000 to 6,000 IU per day, and then get retested in another 2 months. If you're then up in the normal range of, like, let's say 40, then you would reduce the dose to 2,000 IU per day or 4,000 IU every other day or something like that. If it's the winter time, that's probably a good maintenance dose to maintain your level. If it's the summertime, you may not need to do it at all. If you're getting at least 20 to 30 minutes of sun exposure in the midday without any sunblock, that might be sufficient to maintain your levels and you don't need to take any. It's really just a process of trial and error, because as it turns out, there's a large variation in how people convert sunlight to vitamin D. Inflammation and overweight can reduce the conversion of sunlight to vitamin D. So if you have someone dealing with obesity or any kind of inflammatory process, they're not going to, and you know, you put them in the sun for the same amount of time as someone who doesn't have those conditions, they're probably not going to make as much vitamin D from that given exposure to sunlight. And then in terms of orally consumed vitamin D, either from food or supplements, there's a pretty wide variation in how people absorb it, because that, you know, anything that we take as a supplement or eat it as a food, we have to absorb it before it gets to where it gets to. And in my practice, I've seen that a huge, huge range. I mean, some people take 10,000 IU of oral vitamin D per day, and they barely are able to maintain their level doing that. Other people with just 2,000 IU per day, they get up into the 60s and 70s really quickly, and they actually have to stop supplementing. So there's a really wide range, and unfortunately, that doesn't get talked about much in the media. You know, there's just kind of this advice to take vitamin D, and none of these nuances really get discussed. So another thing is, if along those same lines, is if you're not absorbing oral vitamin D in capsule form very well or in food-based form, then you could try a sublingual emulsified or micellized form. Those are better absorbed than the capsule forms for people who have issues. And Biotics makes an emulsified vitamin D that's pretty good. And then Claire Labs makes a micellized form of vitamin D, which is even more absorbable. So these are sublingual products you put under the tongue. But really, the gist of this is you've got to get tested. You've got to do a trial and error supplementation between the tests. And you really need to get tested at least at a couple different times a year, because what's going to work for you in the summer is going to be different than what works for you in the winter. The good news is once you do that testing and once you figure it out, it's generally not going to change very much. So unless you're dealing with some underlying health issues that you then address and improve, then your dose might go down because you'll be absorbing it better from sunlight and from food. But if you do this a few times, you'll figure out your dose, and then you just aim for keeping yourself in a range of 35 to 60. And especially if you're towards the higher end of that range, but even if you're not, you want to always make sure to get enough vitamin A and vitamin K2, because all of the fat-soluble vitamins work synergistically. Vitamin A protects against vitamin D toxicity. Vitamin D and K2 protect against vitamin A toxicity. And a lot of these potential problems with the toxicity of fat-soluble vitamins in high doses could be mitigated or completely avoided by just ensuring an adequate intake of all of them together.
That's a great update on vitamin D. When it comes back to the question from Ben, when he's talking about having a shift schedule, it sounds like what you might suggest to him then would be something like, you know, when he can, before he goes into work, just get a little vitamin D from the sun, and not worry too much about supplementing until he gets his levels tested?
Yeah, get the levels tested first of all. I mean, that's relatively easy. I mean, any doctor will do it. It should be covered by insurance. You can order them on yourself from directlabs.com or my private MD or Accessa Labs. I mean, it's very easy, and it's fairly cheap, so there's no reason not to do it. And once you have a baseline level, then you can determine whether you need any supplementation to be in the 35 to 55 or 60 range.
Got it. Okay. Cool. Well, let's move on to the next question from Mike. He asked, in a recent podcast episode, Stephen asked you if you had a go-to treatment for helping with constipation, and you said, quote, "I often will use magnesium glycinate in fairly high doses. That's a chelated form of magnesium that's easier to absorb, and it doesn't affect the gut in the same way that magnesium citrate and oxide do," end quote. Is this a DIY kind of treatment that I can try? If so, what kind of dosage should I start at, and how high should I go? I'm a 39-year-old male, 5'8", 150 pounds with chronic constipation. Thanks.
Yes, it's definitely a DIY treatment. It's very safe. Magnesium is well tolerated, especially magnesium glycinate. So if with chronic constipation, I'd probably recommend a starting dose of close to 400 milligrams. A lot of the capsules are 120 milligrams. So, you know, three capsules, maybe just before dinner. And then you can increase up to 800 milligrams safely. So that's definitely worth a try, and I would recommend it if you're dealing with chronic constipation. But I will say also that in my experience and from my reading of the scientific literature, chronic constipation is almost always caused by intestinal dysbiosis, so an imbalance of good and bad bacteria in the gut. And in particular, it's often caused by a lack of bifidobacteria in the large intestine. There's a strong association between low levels of bifido and constipation. I talked about that in my gut brain skin axis presentation at the Weston A. Price Foundation, the Wise Traditions Conference that I spoke at recently. So magnesium glycinate can be helpful in a transition period while you're healing your gut, and even long term, because a lot of people, as I've said before, don't get enough magnesium through the diet, even in the context of a healthy diet. But I wouldn't only do that. I would be focusing on gut dysbiosis, and you can get like the organic dysbiosis test to see if there's SIBO or dysbiosis. I would also do a stool profile to make sure there's no pathogens like parasites or bacteria or yeast that can be contributing, because that's often a player in constipation. once you've ruled those things out and dealt with them, though, making sure you're eating plenty of fermented foods, and I've found prebiotics to be more effective for constipation than probiotics in most cases. Now, prebiotics are indigestible starches that selectively stimulate the growth of bifidobacter and other beneficial bacteria in the colon, but they're also FODMAP, so some people may not tolerate them very well. But I've actually found that even for people who are FODMAP intolerant, a small amount of if they're dealing with really intractable constipation, a really small amount of prebiotics can be helpful if they start at a really, really low dose and build up really slowly and carefully. And what this will do is it will dramatically increase the levels of bifidobacter. And since 70 to 80% of the dry weight of stool is bacteria, when you increase the amount of bifidobacter, you're going to increase the bulk of the stool, and that's going to help with chronic constipation in most cases. So that's the long-term goal, is to fix the gut flora, and that will eventually resolve the chronic constipation. But you really need to have a lot of patience with it, because it can take months and in some cases even years. You can't speed it up very easily, because if you take large doses of probiotics or prebiotics just in an effort to do that, you're going to cause yourself a lot of pain and discomfort and probably make the constipation worse rather than better. So it usually just needs to happen really slowly. It requires a lot of patience and a kind of methodical approach, but almost everyone I've worked with, it pays off in the end. Another thing to consider is it's a product called Ageless Hydro-C, and I use it when magnesium glycinate doesn't produce the desired effect, even at 800 milligrams. And Ageless Hydro-C it's a blend of minerals, chelated minerals, not just magnesium, and vitamins. It contains vitamin C and potassium and calcium in a good balance. And that's probably the only risk of taking a high dose of magnesium like that over the long term, is causing a mineral imbalance and with potassium or calcium or other minerals. So if someone's going to be taking a high dose of magnesium or requires that, I might suggest Ageless Hydro-C over the long term to get some of the other minerals. And of course, we want to be addressing the gut dysbiosis throughout that period as well. The last thing I'll say about chronic constipation, another issue, is motility. And some people, it's not as much about the gut flora, it's more about motility, and the natural peristaltic action isn't happening properly. And that can often be a gut-brain axis problem, which we've discussed a few times on the show. And so to deal with that, you want to pay attention to stress management, to hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis health, aka adrenal fatigue syndrome. Serotonin and GABA are two neurotransmitters that are they're produced in large amounts in the gut, in fact, much larger amounts than in the brain. Serotonin in particular is associated with gut motility. So in some cases, 5-HTP, which is a precursor to serotonin, can improve constipation. And it's pretty safe to take, so like 100 milligrams in the evening time. Some practitioners, myself included, will also recommend that if you're taking serotonin 5-HTP in the evening, you want to take some tyrosine in the morning so that you don't create an imbalance of neurotransmitters. Tyrosine is a dopamine precursor. So those are a few things that you can focus on for chronic constipation. And as I said in the beginning, it's also a really good idea to try to rule out small intestine bacterial overgrowth or a fungal infection or a parasitic infection, because a significant percentage of the time with chronic constipation, one of those will be present.
That's an awesome, very distilled overview of chronic constipation. So I appreciate that, Chris. And I'll only add that since I see a lot of this on my site, if this guy is already doing the paleo diet or, a real food diet, or anybody else that's out there and they've tried some of these other things, a lot of times what I also find is people are actually not eating enough fat. And so if another DIY as you step into, you know, getting all the testing done and making sure you're clear of all the potential pathogens and potential hormonal issues is try increasing your fat using some supplemental coconut oil or olive oil or MCT oil. And that can also help move things along. All right. Let's roll on to the next question here. This one comes from Allison, and she asks, what is the best way to retrain one's body to produce higher levels of progesterone without using birth control? Can it be done? I get intense PMS symptoms, painful cramps in my ovaries, in the front of my legs, brain fog, sugar cravings. I'm very irritable every 23 days, accompanied by heavy flow. I was able to delay PMS by using a progesterone cream this month, but I understand that this is not a good long-term solution and that PMS can come back as soon as I have my period.
Yeah, it's difficult to answer on the podcast because it's potentially very complex, but I'll do my best in giving a summary of what the potential issues might be. As I said earlier with the earlier question, with female hormone imbalances, there's 9 times out of 10, there's an underlying adrenal hormone imbalance that's contributing and a dysregulation of the HPA axis. So it's really important to get a test like a cortisol DHEA test to see what the status of the HPA axis is and address any of those issues that are present, because it's really hard to work with a progesterone imbalance or female hormone imbalance when you're not also addressing the adrenal hormones. And of course, stress management would be a big part of addressing an HPA axis issue if there is one, in addition to supplements. Bioidentical progesterone in a sublingual form can actually be helpful here. The reason I'm not a fan of creams, I mean, there are a few reasons, but one of the main reasons is that it's not usually given in a cyclical fashion because it's really hard to dose it accurately. And as I was saying earlier, progesterone needs to be taken at different doses at different times of the month because it's not produced in a linear fashion throughout the month. So again, getting a full monthly hormone profile and then tailoring the dose of progesterone according to the results of that profile is what's going to give you the best results. And this isn't something that you would do forever. The idea is that you get your body back into the optimal range of progesterone production by using progesterone. And it's much easier in general. This is true not just for hormones, but for other conditions. One of the reasons that using supplements like this works is that it's a lot easier for the body to maintain production of something in a normal range than it is for it to get it back to the normal range when it's way outside of it. Does that make sense?
All right, but I'm an engineer.
Right, exactly.
So what you're saying is that if you're way high or way low on a graph and you're trying to get into a range, it's much easier to supplement in order to bring it into the range, and then the body can kind of retrain to that range rather than the body has a really hard time to bring it back to the reference range.
Isn't there some engineering term like tolerance or anyways, whatever.
We don't want to go there.
I'm demonstrating my ignorance of engineering, but yeah, if there's like a normal operating range for hormones, and there is for hormones and pretty much every other substance in the body. We've talked about homeostasis before, which is the body's a state of balance where all of everything is happening within that normal range. And when things get outside of that range, of course, we want to address the underlying mechanism, and that's going to be the key to long-term healing. But sometimes just bringing things back into that normal range is a way of addressing the mechanism. And that's why hormone protocols do work when they're you know, used judiciously and appropriately. So I think all of the things that we talked about in the first question would also apply here. But in addition to that, using some progesterone might be a good idea, but using it in the right way is rather than a cream that's applied at the same dose throughout the month.
You know, the other negatives that I've heard about the progesterone creams is that it's very easy to transfer to another person. So like a kid, if you're holding them, or, you know, a lover, if you're in bed together. So,
right. And the cream tends to build up in the tissues much more than the sublingual stuff because of the way it's applied and because it's free fraction. So, you know, different practitioners have different approaches and philosophies about this stuff, but I prefer the bioidentical sublingual administration for a number of reasons, but probably the main one is the precision of dosing.
Makes complete sense. All right, are we going to roll on to the next one?
Yeah, we have time, I think, for one more.
Okay, great. This next question comes from Gene. My optometrist tells me that I'm developing a cataract in one eye, a nuclear sclerotic, is how he put it. I wonder if there are specific recommendations diet-wise that might either reverse or slow progression or improve, preserve vision in general. Thanks.
Yeah, so for those people who aren't familiar with cataracts, the lens of the eye, which is what allows us to focus, just like the lens of a camera, is filled with a clear protein-containing liquid. And if the proteins in the liquid denature, they get cloudy, and then that can cause the vision to get cloudy. And that's what cataracts are. They can be congenital, which means they're present at birth. They can be caused by physical trauma to the eye. Hypertension and diabetes increase the risk of cataracts, as does living at high altitude. This is another condition that's not very well understood, and there are a lot of different theories about why they happen. But vitamin A, as I'm sure many people know, is a really important vitamin for the health of the eyes. And I think a pretty high dose is required to make progress with cataracts, to either, you know, stop the progression or in some cases improve things. Something like 25 to 50,000 units a day and of retinol, not beta carotene. Beta carotene is the precursor to vitamin A. And although some beta carotene is converted to retinol, the active form of vitamin A, that conversion is pretty poor in humans. So a food-based form like cod liver oil is a really good choice. And if you can't get that much from cod liver oil, you could add some retinol supplementally. But it's very important to get the food-based form. And as I said just a couple of questions ago, it's really important to make sure you're getting enough vitamin D and vitamin K2 if you're going to be taking that dose of vitamin A, because vitamin A can be toxic at high doses when vitamin D and vitamin K2 are deficient. This treatment also, I should point out, shouldn't be used in children. This high dose vitamin A, or in people with severe liver disease. Another option is N-acetylcarnosine eye drops. And this is, there's one product is called CAN-C, C-A-N-C, used twice daily. Another, an herb in the, from both the Western and Chinese pharmacopoeia that can be helpful is bilberry, B-I-L-B-E-R-R-Y, and something like 80 to 120 or 160 milligrams three times a day would be the dose. There's a Chinese herb called Bai Wei Wan, and that's really can be helpful in this situation. There's a formula called, is it Clinical Nutrients for the Eyes? It's by Phytopharmaca. So I would do these things and try it for 6 months or so. And if it doesn't work and the cataracts are continuing to progress, the surgery is usually pretty effective and pretty safe as surgeries go. I mean, there's always a risk with surgery, but it's not one that's particularly problematic.
Do you have any thoughts on, does that include like LASIK surgery?
Is LASIK effective?
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on LASIK as well, as since we're talking about eye surgeries?
Yeah, I haven't looked into Lasix in detail, but just anecdotally from what I've heard, it is pretty effective and doesn't tend to, I have a number of patients that have had Lasix and have been happy with it, but it's not something I've studied much myself.
Gotcha.
I think we have time for one more. The next one is pretty short, so I think we can do that.
All right. This is a good one. Banged through a lot of questions today. Okay, the last question for today's podcast comes from Tim. He says, Chris, I recently started taking fermented cod liver oil from Green Pasture after reading a few of your articles where you mentioned the health benefits. Unfortunately, this stuff is giving me some pretty bad reflux, and I am taking a very low dose, 0.5 milliliters. I've tried mixing it with a few different fruit and vegetable smoothies to aid in digestion, and so far, grass-fed milk with banana seems to help the most, but I still get a little bit of reflux. I don't want to quit as I want to get the benefits of this potential nutritional value of FCLO, but the reflux is making it very hard to continue. Any suggestions on what I can do to help digest this stuff easier?
Yeah, if that small of a dose is causing problems, I wonder if he has problems digesting other fats or if it's just particularly the fermented cod liver oil. I'll try to answer both ways. So if it's trouble also with other fats or fish oils, then something like ox bile could be helpful, and cholagogues like dandelion root, ginger, milk thistle, beetroot powder, in an effort to get the gallbladder functioning better to help with fat digestion. Could also spread the dose. Sounds like he's taking a small dose already, but could spread it out throughout the day. So instead of taking it once a day, take it three times a day and even smaller doses. If it's only a problem with the fermented cod liver oil, then some more investigation would probably be helpful. Do other cod liver oils or fish oils cause the problem, or is it only fermented cod liver oil? The oil is usually better tolerated than the capsules in terms of this problem of belching, but some people who have the belching with the oil who've tried the capsules are actually do better with the capsules. So you might want to try, they have a fermented cod liver oil, butter oil blend with the capsules. And if you take those with food, if you take the capsules at the beginning of a meal and then eat the meal, that can sometimes, because you're digesting it with the rest of a meal, that can sometimes help. The Adaptogest product that Rob Wolf and I created as part of the Paleologics line has a number of cholagogues and other nutrients that are helpful in this situation. That's, this is kind of one of the scenarios that we were imagining when we designed the Paleologics line, not specifically fermented cod liver oil, but problems with fat digestion in general. So try some of those things and get back to us. Let us know how you do. And also let us know if you're having issues with other fat digestion or if it's just the fermented cod liver oil or cod liver oil in general or fish oil, because that will help determine, what you do from there.
Great stuff. Well, we were all over the board today, Chris. Is there anything else you want to let the listeners know about?
I don't think so. I just wish everyone happy holiday season. Hope you have, however it is that you spend the time. If you're with family, I hope you enjoy that. And we'll be back next year. We're going to be talking with Dan Party and Stefan Guinet about a pretty exciting new weight loss program they put together. So I'm looking forward to that.
Good deal. Yes. Everyone have a happy holidays of your choice and spend a lot of time with your friends and family, do a lot of laughing. And we appreciate you listening to this podcast. If you want to get more of Chris, other than the chriscresser.com, you can also go over to Facebook, and that's Facebook.com/ChrisCresserLAC. Or you can catch him on Twitter, where he sends out a lot of different papers and stuff that he doesn't necessarily always blog about. And that's Twitter.com/ChrisCresser. So thanks again for listening. And if you want us to keep sending us your questions, we do our best to get through as many as what we can. Send those to chriscresser.com. Go over to the podcast submission link and go ahead and put those in there. And if you enjoyed listening to the show, head over to iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps us get more listeners, more people who, you know, as you review us, we get higher rankings and more people get to hear this message. So it helps more people. So we really appreciate it when you do that. So thanks, everyone. And we'll talk to you on the next episode.
Thanks, everybody. Take care.